Thanks very much, Tom. It's a great pleasure to introduce my friend and colleague, Charlie Morrison. Charlie is the president of Fidelity Asset Management. He's been at Fidelity a little under 30 years. A graduate of Dartmouth and the Harvard Business School, Charlie's had most of his time at Fidelity on the fixed income side of the business, starting as a bond analyst and working up to the point where he actually ran the entire business, a $770 billion operation. Today, as the president of Fidelity's asset management organization, he has an organization of some 3,700 people, and they work in some 12 countries around the world. The organization itself collectively manages $2.4 trillion for some 24 million customers. So when we talked to Charlie about coming down here, we didn't have any problem because we told him it was warm and sunny. So he's here from Boston. Give a warm welcome to my friend Charlie.
Thank you, sir. Hello, everybody. Thank you, Jim. That was very nice of you to introduce me. It's been a pleasure working with you as closely as I have for the past number of years. Let me start by acknowledging something that I think you should all feel very good about, and that's the fact that you're not in Boston, right? I flew down yesterday. It was snowing again. We've got 9 feet of snow on the ground, just about 9 feet of snow on the ground. We are just coming off the second coldest February in the Northeast region ever, right? So that 9 feet of snow we've had has not really melted yet. And sadly, they're actually talking about canceling the St. Patrick's Day Parade in Boston. And I know how big of a deal that is here in Naples, and it's very sad to hear that. They haven't decided yet, but the snowbanks are too big. People can't see. It's incredible. Only in Boston, roofs are leaking. My roof, I found out yesterday, is leaking. Roofs are collapsing. The MBTA is, which is our public transit system, so people commuting in and out of the city, is completely falling apart. It's a disaster, and people are actually rooting for more snow, right? They really are. They want to break the record. We're like 1.3 inches away from breaking the record. I mean, it's a little crazy, so a little sad. So to say that I'm happy to be here today is a bit of an understatement. So privileged to be here. I do want to thank Tom Wheeler, Jim, obviously Bill Burns, another Fidelity person here today, for bringing me in and giving me this opportunity to get in front of all of you. It is a bit of a family affair for me. I actually have two aunts here. I have an uncle, and my parents are here. It's my parents. My parents drove over from Stewart. They've been residents here in Florida now for 20-some-odd years. Is that right? And so it's great to see them. As I was flying down yesterday in the airplane, I was trying to remember the last time that my parents actually saw me in front of an audience. Right? And think about this. The last time that they saw me in front of an audience, I believe, was when I was in middle school in the band playing the tuba. So it... That may be a tough act to follow, actually. So it's a treat for me to have them here, and very happy to be here. So hopefully many of you know something about Fidelity. But before I dig in here, I wanted to give you a sense of who we are as an organization. We touch a lot of people. We cover a lot of territory. And it oftentimes provides us with some very interesting insights and visibility on trends that we're seeing, not only in the markets, but also what's happening with our customers. So first off, just to give you a sense of who we are one of the largest financial service organizations in the country. Jim had mentioned the assets under management that we have. We also are a very big player in servicing retirement accounts for much of corporate America, as well as many municipalities. So when you roll it all up, we actually have responsibility for about $5 trillion in assets under administration. We trade over $1 trillion in equities every year with our equity mutual funds. We have over 800 investment professionals. And one little known fact, and I think it's a particularly important fact for this crowd here, is that we operate one of the largest independent public charities in the country, and that's Fidelity Charitable. And we are second only to the United Way. So it is a tremendous way to give back. It's an advised donor fund. So I encourage people to take a look at the website at some point if you'd like, because it's a wonderful way to give to the next generation and to your favorite charities. So our scale and reach provides us, as I mentioned, a lot of insights into these trends, interesting trends that we're seeing. That's occurring both within the financial markets and our customers. You know, what are our customers saying? What are they doing? What are they concerned about? And whenever I'm in front of groups like this, I do try and share some of the things that that we learn that you may not hear from others that come and speak to you. So needless to say, there are no shortage of things that that we could have focused on today or that I could have focused on today. But as I thought about it, and I thought about this very specific audience, there was one very important trend that I wanted to target my remarks on. And then I'm going to spend a couple of minutes talking about the markets. So let me kick off by focusing on an issue here that's getting more and more attention, and that's this massive transfer of wealth that we're seeing. And I'm sure many here are familiar with that. This has started with the great transfer that we're seeing. Some are calling this the great transfer, where the greatest generation, those born in the 20s and 30s, some of you here, are expected to share over $12 trillion in assets with their heirs. Right, and those heirs are the baby boomer generation, folks like myself. Now, we've come across some interesting insights based on the research that we've conducted and conversations that we've had with our customers that are tied to this transition of assets. And to be frank, you know, some of it's a little bit unsettling. So it's worth sharing because of the message I think it sends to us as a financial services company that's trying to respond to the needs of our customers. But I also, as I mentioned, I think it's important for you all, this particular audience, because I think it's relevant to many here. So first, let me share some of the facts. Now, I just spoke about this great transfer. Well, there's a second and even larger wealth transfer from the boomers to their kids, and that's starting now, right? And that's going to continue over the next 30 to 40 years, and that's estimated to be at $30 trillion. So in the next 10 to 15 years, 10% of total wealth in the U.S. is expected to be changing hands every 5 years. So the clear message here is that we're seeing a tremendous amount of money, tremendous dollars in motion, and that movement impacts virtually every single family we interact with at Fidelity. 23 million investors, right? It's impacting every single one. In particular, it's impacting their children, and it's impacting their spouses. So take this big movement of wealth and juxtapose that with these facts. 70% of estates collapse in the first generation of a wealth transfer. So if there's one thing that I want you to remember as you walk out of here, it's that statistic. 70% of estates lose control of their assets in that first transfer of wealth. Right? That's an amazing, shocking statistic. Now imagine many here are self-made, right, and are going to be faced with that first generation transfer at some point down the road. Remember that statistic. When you think about it, this transfer of wealth is also a lot like winning the lottery, right? Here too, the evidence shows that 90% of lottery winners go through their winnings in 5 years or less. Right? That's pretty amazing. Not a lot of time to go through a parent's life savings. The research also shows that many primary investors in the household, which tends to be the men of the house, feel that if something were to happen to them, their spouse or partner would have trouble managing their assets. Okay? In fact, 90% of women will have to manage their finances on their own at some point in their lives, right? And that's either going to be as a result of outliving their husbands or divorce. And we're finding that most are not prepared. Disturbing stats, right? So when you roll it all up, it's not a rosy picture, Many families are just not ready. And even those we're finding that have had these conversations in their families are really not prepared, are really not ready. So why is this the case? Well, what we're finding that it really comes down to one very simple thing: poor communication or not enough communication. Now, we've done a lot of research and analysis on this issue, and it's revealed that the single most important driver in failed wealth transfers were a result of significant communication gaps with families on financial topics. The natural tendency in most families is to avoid communicating about wealth. You know, we avoided communicating about wealth for a little while. We finally got our act together. We've had some good conversations. Now I found I'm not getting anything, but that's okay. It's all going to my brother and my sister. That's why I invited my parents here today, because I wanted to make sure they heard that it's very important to continue these conversations, so maybe we can change that, Beth. So that statistic I shared with you earlier, that 70% of families losing control of their assets, the primary reason, again, it's all about communication. And when you hear some of the verbatims, some of the research verbatims that we get from our customers, it's not really that surprising. So let me share just a couple. Quote, "My kids," and my kids being adult kids here, "don't want in-depth discussions. I believe that they think it's too much to know about our assets." Quote, "I don't want my kids to start counting how much money they'll get when I die." Some of these may resonate. Quote, "It's difficult to talk to your own family about money because you don't want to hurt any relationships." Now, these quotes were all taken from 60-plus-year-old customers with over $1 million in assets and with adult children. Right? People are just not connecting. So the bottom line here is that this lack of communication is absolutely leading to significant loss of wealth in families. It's a sad thing because it's avoidable. So we're also finding that by not having the conversation, most people don't realize the impact it's having on their kids. Right, so what are your kids saying about this? First and foremost, they are stressed. Right? Why is that? They worry that they're going to have to take care of you at some point. Adult children are 7 times more likely to say than the actual parent that they're going to have to care for that parent. Right? There's a huge disconnect here. And for those who have already had the conversations with their kids want you to go deeper. They want to be better prepared, right? It's not a one-and-done kind of thing. One conversation does not cover it. Needs change, circumstances change, needs to be an ongoing dialogue. Now, I recognize where I am, right? I'm in Naples, Florida. The demographics here suggest that you are above average planners, right? I'm sure many of you already had the conversation, but my point here is that it's just not possible to over-communicate when it comes to this. For those who have yet to engage, I encourage you to connect, open up, don't wait. For those who have already engaged, you know, continue the dialogue. My hope really in bringing this up today is just to spur some action. You know, we see the devastation. I am unbelievably passionate about this. You know, as a culture, we need to change the family conversation. We need to get people to get comfortable having these conversations with their families. And as a parent and a spouse, I think I have that responsibility. So just to close on this particular thing, and then I get to some of the funner things on the markets, we often get the question, what is the best way to start that conversation? Well, it may be a lot easier than you think. All you really need to do is you need to grab your kids, you need to grab your spouse, sit them aside, and ask them one very simple question. What is your wish for the future? And then don't impose your opinion on that. Just listen. You'll be surprised, I think, at what you get back. So enough of the public service announcement on that. Let me shift gears here and turn attention to the markets. I'm going to start by focusing on interest rates, and that may be a bit of an odd spot to begin, but I am a bit of a bond geek. I've spent, as Jim had mentioned, close to 30 years in the fixed income markets following interest rates, believe it or not, and yield curves and things of that sort, and it's an area that I am very familiar with and believe drives a lot what goes on in other markets. But there are other reasons for focusing on this. First, who here has not felt the pain of low interest rates over the past number of years, right? With anybody? Right. I mean, it's pretty remarkable. Money market funds at one basis point, it's been very, very painful. Quick aside here, believe it or not, we're just talking about this at our table. There are others in the world that have it worse than we do. Okay. What do you think is the fastest growing asset class in Europe? It's not some equity market, some new equity market. The fastest growing asset class in Europe are European government bonds that offer a negative yield. Right? 60% of Germany's outstanding debt trades with a negative yield. Basically means that the German government is taxing you when you buy their debt. I mean, you give them a dollar or a euro, and they'll give you some fraction of that back a number of years later. I mean, it's fascinating. There was a company, a French utility, that offered at a new debt offering this week. They offered two-year debt at zero interest rate, zero return. I mean, that's what we're dealing with in the world these days. Another reason for focusing on rates is I do believe that relief is in sight here. The Fed has indicated that they're likely to raise rates here over some period of time. You know, we believe that that's likely to be sometime during the summer months. We believe that would be quite bullish for many other markets. And if they raise rates twice over the next 6 months, that could be even more so bullish. And when rates do move, and history shows this to be the case, when rates do move, that will certainly influence the performance of many other markets. All you need to do is look back to May of 2013 when Fed Chairman Greenspan cut out quantitative easing, which is a tool that the Fed was using at the time to dampen interest rates. They decided they were going to do away with that. Once they did, we had the Dow drop 600 points in 2 days. We had long treasuries off 15% over the next month. It was a bit of a bloodbath. So I think we're going to see a lot of volatility. We could see a lot of volatility, which could lead to some real opportunities when the Fed begins to raise rates. So let me just take a quick step back here and set some broader context and give you an idea as to how we're thinking about the world. For the past 6 months or so, the economic landscape in the world has been defined by growing economic and monetary policy divergences across the spectrum, across the world, U.S. versus the rest of the world. The U.S. economy is clearly strengthening here. We've seen recent releases of the GDP a week or so ago come out. You know, we've had some moderate growth in the U.S., and as I just mentioned, the Fed is much closer to monetary tightening and raising rates. While most other large economies around the world, in Europe and Asia, have experienced slower and disappointing growth, and their central banks are looking at continuing to ease monetary policy, lower interest rates. So Europe is currently what we call a mid-cycle expansion. You know, growth and profits are peaking here, we believe, and we believe also that it's likely to remain weak for some period of time. We don't expect a recession there, but we do expect it to be weak. Japan has entered into a mild recession. China, a major engine of global growth around the world, is slowing, and saw the news this week, the premier reducing their growth estimates in China. And we all know what's going on with oil. Oil has fallen dramatically. I think it's the only positive thing that people in Boston are looking at this year is that their oil bills are going down. But other commodities are also weak. You know, broad industrial commodity indices were down over 10% over the past year. And this all suggests, it all rolls up and suggests that the growth backdrop outside the U.S. is quite weak and disinflationary pressures continue to be widespread. So when you turn to the U.S., I must say that I'm feeling better about the economy here than I have in probably close to a decade. Job growth has been quite strong. We're seeing the unemployment rate dropping at the fastest rate that it's dropped in over 30 years. Incomes are growing strongly in real terms. You know, inflation's quite low. Gas prices are down. Wage growth is up. Everybody saw the news on Walmart. They're bumping up their wages on some of their entry-level employees, which is a great thing. The deficit has fallen. The fiscal drag is fading. And on the earnings front, we're feeling better and better. Every year, given the 2-plus trillion in assets that we have under management, we get a lot of companies that come in that would like us to invest with them. And so we have upwards of 5,000 companies come through our doors every year. So we get a pretty good view as to what's going on in the economy and how people are thinking about the world. In 2015, we expect it to be the sixth year in a row of positive earnings growth. I think this year could be a little bit different here. We've got a little bit of a tug of war between some real strength in the dollar and weakness in energy. And for example here, that impacts the auto business, you know, with the weak dollar. Obviously, it's tougher to have sales outside of the U.S., but with a strong dollar, but with weak energy, you've got some high-ticket items, much more attractive SUVs and luxury vehicles that are doing quite well. So a little bit of a tug of war here in the U.S. The bottom line here is that we think business is doing quite well and continues to strengthen. So when you roll it all up, obviously a far cry from where we were in 2008, and from my perspective, I think it's clear that the strengthening economic fundamentals are becoming a little bit more detached from what we see in the low rate environment. So as I talked about, I do expect to see the Fed to begin hiking rates here at some point, not going out on a limb. I mean, they've been consistent with their guidance here, and we see it middle of this year and likely to be measured. So I think that's a good thing for the economy, and it's a good thing for the markets. So that's the rates picture. I think we're headed higher. Let's turn to the equity markets. Positive growth in the U.S. has certainly been reflected in the equity markets since the financial meltdown of 2008. We're actually coming up on a big date here, March 9th. All right, March 9th, despite the fact that it's my father's 82nd birthday. Happy birthday. March 9th is the anniversary of the lows in the equity market. Right, so back in 2009, March 9th, we had the S&P at 666. Right, it's now over 2,100. We have seen the S&P rise 210% since those March 2009 lows. That's up over 35% versus 2007 and the highs in 2007. So we've come a long, long way in the equity markets, and we're also coming off a very strong 2014. The U.S. crushed the rest of the world last year. The S&P was up 14%. Europe was down 6% in dollar terms. Japan was down. The emerging markets were down. Really strong year for the U.S. 2014 was also another strong year when we saw broad indices. Right, broad indices like the S&P and passively managed funds, index strategies, do quite well. Now, let me pause here for a minute on this because there's been a lot of noise about index funds and passively managed products in the news as of late, a tremendous amount of noise about this. And I'm sure many in the audience have focused some or all of their investments in index funds and passively managed strategies. I get the questions all the time. I had a question earlier today about it. Of late, past number of years, being invested in passive strategies has been absolutely the right thing to do. In fact, industry-wide, over the past 5 years, only 22% of actively managed funds have beaten their benchmarks. Fidelity's done a little bit better, but talk about that later. This is largely due to the events of 2008, when the financial collapse happened, central banks around the world were moving in tandem, were taking rates down, and that caused everything to move together. Right, correlations, tendency for stocks to move together throughout the past number of years have been very, very high. And dispersions, where differences in stock returns, where you see differences how stocks trade, have been very, very low. So that has led to a very strong environment for passively managed assets. So the passive markets have been absolutely killing it. So I get these questions all the time. Is active management dead? Should I move all my assets to index funds? Well, my response here, it's not an either or question, right? There are reasons for having exposure to both. There are benefits to both active, benefits to passive. But I can say with strong conviction that active management is certainly not dead and far from it. I can point to countless examples within Fidelity, within the industry, where active managers have been outperforming their benchmarks for the past number of years. One person in particular, Joel Tillinghast, which is a portfolio manager that began 25 years ago, was hired by Peter Lynch. He started a fund, the Low Price Stock Fund. Had you invested in the Low Price Stock Fund 25 years ago, $10,000, that could be worth upwards of $300,000 today, right? Just that $10,000 invested. Had you invested in his passively managed benchmark, in the benchmark, that'd be worth about $100,000 today. So there's an increment of $200,000. In an environment where it's been very difficult for active managers to outperform, Joel Tillinghast has gotten it done incredibly well. The data also shows that this active versus passive phenomenon is very much a cyclical phenomenon. Right? There are times where where active management does quite well, and there are times when passive management does quite well, and it's 3 to 5 year increments. You can actually see it. It's very clear. And in my mind, we're entering an environment today very much in support of active management. And why is that? Well, the world is a very different place. You know, we're not seeing the same kind of coordination around the world with central bank easing. We've seen a significant decrease in broad systemic risk. You know, the Fed, as I mentioned, is likely to raise rates. Volatility is going to pick up. And an increase in volatility is likely going to lead to a drop in correlations in the equity market. And we're already beginning to see this. U.S. stocks have started to go their own way. And in fact, we're seeing a gap now between the best and worst performing sectors in the S&P at its widest point in the past number of years. So as the Fed prepares to raise rates here for the first time since 2006, I do think investors are going to be able to discern winners and losers in the equity markets. And we're seeing this actually in the performance of many of our actively managed equity funds. So active, I believe, is obviously far, far from being dead. So let me wrap up here on the markets and make a few comments, and then I'll give you some thoughts around where I see opportunities in these markets. So rates, I believe, are going up. I think there are some attractive areas here. I think you want to shy away from the long end of the yield curve. We're clearly constructive on the equity market. Really no clouds that we can see at the moment, other than, you know, there's always potential for geopolitical risk, but there's nothing that's we're particularly concerned about at the moment. We see there's a fair amount of room for these markets to go. You know, so we do expect, as I mentioned, some positive earnings growth to come, and valuations are continue to be in a relatively neutral space. So we think there's opportunity for the equity markets just broadly to continue to do well here. So let me finish up and hit some opportunities that I see in the market. First off, I have to say that I am not a licensed rep, so these are really just my own opinions. In the income space at this point in the cycle, I am focused on short to intermediate duration bond funds. Resist the temptation here to chase yield by going into longer duration assets. Two funds that I like. One is the Fidelity Total Bond Fund, and most of these are going to be Fidelity funds for the obvious reasons, I guess. The the Fidelity Total Bond Fund, which was recently named one of Kiplinger's 6 best bond funds to buy now. It's a diversified fund, medium term. It's over the past 10 years, it's averaged about 5% annualized return and handily outperforming its benchmark. So a very solid offering there. Another is the Fidelity Floating Rate High Income Fund, another Kiplinger favorite. It's one of the 6 to buy now. It focuses on high quality sub-investment grade bank debt. And it's very short duration. The reason I like this in this particular environment, very short duration. It yields about just over 4%. And as rates rise, as we expect, we'll see this fund ought to benefit from that. Excuse me. Let's not forget about munis. I'm sure municipals are quite popular with many folks here in this room. The muni market last year returned roughly 9%. We don't expect that kind of returns in 2015, but the technicals here in this market are quite good. Fundamentals continue to improve. We see State tax revenues continue to improve, as well as the real estate markets. So that's all positive for, more broadly, the supporting of the municipal market. A couple names in the headlines I would continue to steer clear of. You know, continue to see some stress: Puerto Rico, Illinois, and New Jersey. But overall, we think the muni market remains very high quality, and there are names out there we do like: California, Florida, New York, all names we like. One very specific credit that we like a little bit more locally here is Naples Community Hospital. It's a single-A rated hospital. It is dominates, obviously, this market. You all know it quite well. Very strong balance sheet and very attractive service area, too. So that's one name that we do like. Fund I like in the muni space is the Fidelity Intermediate Muni Income Fund. Very well diversified fund, not too long, and it's averaged about 4% in terms of returns over the past 5 years. So shifting to the equity market, three funds I like here. The Fidelity Capital and Income Fund, very experienced portfolio manager, Mark Nocken. He's has great combination of income with capital appreciation, particularly in this market. The credit cycle remains quite strong. And Mark is very much an opportunistic investor in the equity market, and he's done quite well. He's beaten over 100% of his peers on a 1 and 3 year basis, and 94% on a 5 year basis. So very strong performance with the Fidelity Capital and Income Fund. Fidelity Equity Income Fund. Here you get equity income as well as a balance of capital appreciation and some downside protection. A very conservative way to increase your equity allocation. We've had some great returns here as well. SEC yield is in the roughly 2.5% to 3% range. And then finally, the Fidelity Event-Driven Opportunities Fund. This is somewhat of an uncorrelated offering here. It's really focused on special situations, corporate reorganizations. We launched this fund back in 2013, so it's still relatively new, but it's off to a great start. It's beating the S&P benchmark by about 100 basis points so far this year. So there you have it. You know, we see the U.S. economy continuing to strengthen, as I mentioned, tempered by some global weakness. The equity markets, I think, still provide some real opportunity here, despite this rising rate environment. But it really is time to pick your spots, right? I mean, I think it is time to focus on active managers and take advantage of the value that we see as we cycle into an environment here that's going to support active management. Been a real pleasure to be here today, and I want to thank all those in the audience who are Fidelity customers for placing your trust in us, and I look forward to some questions.
Charlie, that was fabulous. Thank you very much. We give our speakers two books, one on Marco Island and one in Naples. I'll take them to the chair. Thank you very
much. Thank you
very much.
Nicely done. Thank you for having me.
And Jim, do you want to come forward with the questions? Now, Jim, because he's a sort of an ally of Charlie, he promised me he wouldn't just give him softballs. So.
I got a handful of softballs here.
Well, you've obviously stirred the audience. We got a hell of a lot of questions, so you may have to cancel your flight, stay another day. First of all, we saw some wonderful high school students here today, and I now know they're really, really smart, because one of the questions is from one of the young ladies in the high school, and her question is, she wants to know, what are two or three of the stocks that Ned Johnson bought this last week?
Really? I think we may have to skip that one.
Anyway, to get serious for a minute, could you please comment on how Fidelity is protecting its customers from the types of cyber attacks that we read about in the newspaper at Home Depot and Target and so on?
Sure. You know, it's a great question. If there's one thing that as an organization we are focused on, it is making sure that we're protecting our customers and protecting their data. Cybersecurity is obviously a huge issue for us now. I mean, the landscape here is a little frightening. You know, the threat level is up quite dramatically. We've seen bad actors. We've seen nation states. We've seen, you know, folks come at us from all different angles. Just to give you a sense as to the kind of activity that we do see there, we blocked last year over a billion spam messages. We blocked, I think it was close to 100 million malicious web attacks coming at us. So it's only increasing. And on top of that, just fraud and folks or those bad actors out there, the fraud threat has continued to rise. So we're focused on this in a number of different ways. Clearly, our top focus is on the customer. But we need to look from an external perspective, make sure that we're covered, but also internally, too. You know, we've got 40 all in. We've got, close to 45,000 employees now. We need to make sure that we're protecting ourselves from both inside and out. There are a couple of things, actually, I could offer in terms of things that people here ought to be doing that could actually help us. So it is a digital world now, and people need to make sure that they're paying very close attention to their digital footprint. And what I mean by that is know what's on the web about you. Go out, take a look at what's on LinkedIn, take a look at what's on Facebook, and have a good understanding of what's out there. Make sure that you are taking care of your passwords. You hear about this all the time. Make sure they're unique. But what we're finding is passwords are becoming easier and easier to get through. So we are beginning to push second factor authentication. And what that means is setting up if you were to transact in your account, make sure that you set up an opportunity for you to be alerted of whatever transactions may happen through another device that you may be working on, through a phone or something. So you get a text if someone is trying to do something in your account. That way, you can obviously manage what's going on with the activity in your account. We're seeing that has been a very effective way of making sure that people are protecting themselves. Make sure you update your software, right? Make sure your browser's updated, your malicious software protection is also updated as well. So there's a lot of things that you can do to help yourselves and help us as well.
Okay. Charlie, are there any interesting new products you're thinking about at Fidelity?
Yeah, I mean, we're always focused on new products. We spend a lot of time talking to our customers, our folks from the branches, and making sure that we're getting feedback in terms of what's of interest to folks. A couple areas in particular that we're really focused on is in the solution space. Solutions are really the growth area for the asset management business or industry, I believe. It's less about mutual funds these days. People come to us and they want solutions. They want to understand how we can help them with life outcomes. So we're spending a lot of time in the product space trying to develop solutions and make it easier for people to interact with Fidelity and come away with solutions for themselves. So very much focused in the digital space. So digital managed accounts, making it easier for the young investor to come in. The young investors are very focused on not having to interact with people on the phone, right? I mean, we all see it, and I see it with my kids, right? Everything is on the phone now, and everything is text, everything is online. And it's so we're working on an offering there that I think will be of use. We're very focused on women investors, right? Coming up with new ways, the web experience with women investors and things to make their involvement with and their connection to the financial markets and education within the financial markets a little bit easier to occur. But specifically on the product front, ETFs continue to be an area of focus for us. We've got some actively managed fixed income ETFs that we've rolled out over the past year. We'll see more activity there, hopefully on the equity side and really in the solution space.
Okay. Here's one right down the middle. At what age do you tell your children about your assets and what they expect to inherit? And there's a second question. How do you think a family should begin the conversation about personal assets?
So the age question we get a lot, and I think you need you don't want to be talking to your 10-year-old son, right? You will know when the time is right, right? When they're adults, when they can have a serious conversation about financials, you can have that conversation. But it can start It all depends on what it is that you want to hit. So back to the question that I said, what are your wishes for the future? Right? I mean, that's a pretty simple question. You could ask a 10-year-old that question. Right? I mean, they may not have an idea as to, you know, what direction they want to go, but you could ask someone that question. It's all about beginning the dialogue, and then you change the dialogue as time goes on. So I think it does depend on, you know, there's no right answer there in terms of an age, but I think you want to make sure that at some point, as your kids reach, you know, their late teens and early 20s, you start to have a little bit more serious conversation about wealth and about your assets. Sorry, what was the second part of that question, Jim?
You don't remember it?
I don't remember it. No.
I think it had something to do with student debt.
Student debt.
I'm going to be kidding. You covered it.
Okay.
How about, will Fidelity Investments ever issue a public stock offering?
I'm going to turn that right over to you.
That's because it's a very simple question. No.
No. Yeah. Yeah.
Been a private company since Ned's father founded it many years ago. And I think one significant thing about that is of the 44,000 people that work for us, a very, very significant portion actually owns stock in the company, and they buy that stock. So you're dealing with a firm that has what we call skin in the game. They're working not only for you, but they're working for themselves. That's been Ned Johnson's philosophy from day one, and I can tell you, as a 33-year veteran working with him, it works.
There are a lot of people like me at the firm who have been there for 30-plus years, and it is one of the reasons they stayed that long is because of the private ownership. And we invest for the long term. Private ownership allows us to think about the future. We don't manage our business quarter to quarter. We're willing to take risks on products. We're willing to take risks for the benefit of our customers, and we can do it because we're private.
Family owns 49%. Employees own 51%. The federal debt, does it worry you? Obviously, it doesn't worry Obama. Well, I guess I better get on a plane then. Huh?
Yeah, yeah. It absolutely worries me. I mean, if you think about where we are with the debt outstanding. So we have basically doubled our outstanding debt, the U.S., since 2008. But the cost, because of interest rates coming down, I mean, we haven't felt this burden because of rates having dropped as much as they have. We're basically paying half what we paid in 2008 in terms of interest costs as a country. So the concern is, obviously, that as rates begin to back up, this is going to be a lot more expensive for us as a country, and it's going to be a lot more difficult to deal with. So, yes, it is something I'm very concerned about.
If you had a significant investment portfolio with about 25% cash, what would you do with it, with the cash?
Well, you know, that is a very personal question, right? Not personal for me, but personally. I mean, everyone has their own risk tolerance and how they think about the world and what their own economic situation is. 25% in cash today, where it's paying nothing. With my view in terms of our view in terms of where we think the equity markets could go, opportunities and actually extending, even if you wanted to stay very conservative, extending out the curve a little bit. There's a great product that we have, the Conservative Income Bond Fund, takes you out the curve just a very short period, you know, about a year or so. You can pick up 40, 50 basis points, a very conservative option for you. But I think there are real opportunities still in the equity markets, and I would continue to focus on shifting some of the assets there.
Very interesting question. What do you think of robo-advisors? How will they affect the wealth transfer, i.e., will the kids spurn the active management?
That's a great question. Robo-advisors are it's a topic that we are spending a lot of time focused on. We've actually been we've got a SWAT team internally focusing on a digital managed account offering for the young investors. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, the young investors, they don't want to engage the way that we've all engaged over the years. And so this is an offering that we need to make sure we get in front of our young investors to educate them so that they get comfortable with investing in the markets. This is something that works. We're seeing Many of our competitors do the same kind of thing with some success. And I think the more we can draw the younger generation into the market, you got to remember, and I think about my kids, right? They've really only been exposed to markets that have caused real issues for people, right? I mean, if you go back to 2008 in the financial crisis and the impact that that had broadly on families across the country, it was quite significant and left very much a lasting impression on them. Here's a generation that's very focused on passive investing, right? They don't see the value in active investing. Robo-advisors will contribute to that. So, but if we can engage them and bring them in and get them focused on the markets, that's a good thing. And then we can get them more comfortable with taking more risk as time goes on and thinking about actively managed strategies.
Do you support the Federal Reserve Board's activities?
Well, it depends which way they're going. Actually,
the great answer.
I've spent a tremendous amount of time in Washington over the past 5-6 years or so, and we have a close connection with the Federal Reserve. We go in on a regular basis and meet with the chair. We had a very good connection with Bernanke and now developing one with Janet Yellen. This is in large part due to the fact that we're as big as we are and that we serve so many customers. They want to hear from us. They want to hear what our customers are saying. They want to see how we're reacting to market events. I am very impressed with the Fed. Very smart people. There was a big reorganization there this week, actually. The New York Fed lost a little bit of control and shifting down to Washington in terms of bank regulation. But I think the Fed does a great service for this country, obviously, and we're going to continue to work very closely with them and make sure that we continue to educate them because we want them to be very careful in terms of some of the policy decisions that they make so that it doesn't influence the asset management industry in a way that would be painful.
Well, here's kind of a follow-up question. We have an $18 trillion debt, and it's growing by the day. If we don't address this, what is going to eventually be the impact on your industry?
Well, it goes well beyond our industry. If we don't address the debt situation, then the U.S. certainly becomes we see real strength in the dollar. We see people continue to flock to the United States in times of stress. I think that changes things quite dramatically if we can't get our house in order. So we have a lot of work to do there, I'm hopeful that we have potentially a new administration coming in the next couple of years, that would be quite, I think, supportive in terms of how we as a country manage our debt.
Well, we didn't get to all of your questions. I apologize, but Tom tells me it's 1:30 and it's time to leave. So thank you very much.
Thank you.